Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan coming to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. And today in the show,
we need to move away from minimising the experience of early pregnancy loss. We need to move towards validation, empathy and understanding.
Today is Infant Loss Remembrance Day and bereaved parents are asking for more support. We investigated more. Also, we investigated if artificial intelligence on military weaponry is ethical. And later today,
starting from the federal government level, there has never been a policy or set of policies that would encourage manufacturers to bring electric vehicles to the country.
We found out why Australia is getting behind on electric cars to reduce carbon emissions. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, Australia is reaching the vaccination targets of the national plan to open its international borders. Today, New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet announced the state will open its international borders next month and will scrap the hotel quarantine system. While this is good news for Australians stranded overseas, a new survey found out the journey for them is not over. The Wire's Demetra Allen found out more.
The survey included more than 1,300 stranded Australians overseas to see how they were affected by Australia's border closure at the beginning of the pandemic. Associate Professor from the School of Population Health at the University of New South Wales, Holly Seal, was part of the research team and says the border closure is taking a toll on the participants.
This is a program of work that's being led by a School of Population Health student, Pippa McDermott, and Pippa's work really has been looking into the health and financial impacts of being stranded overseas. And this isn't just for Australians, but for any person who has been unable to either return to their country of origin or the country that they're working in or residing in because of travel restrictions. And, you know, we have found, you know, that there is such a large number of people who remain stranded overseas, you know, because of the pandemic and what's happened with changes in borders, including such a large number of Australians who can't return home.
The survey found out stranded travellers were experiencing moderate to high levels of depression and anxiety and no support from the federal government.
You know, we've been finding, you know, that they are reporting, moderately to high levels of depression and anxiety, you know, which is perhaps not surprising given, you know, what they say about having, you know, multiple flights being cancelled or delayed or changes in travel plans or travel plans fall through and remaining in situations where, you know, they're having to draw on, their finances, you know, the you know, seeking funds from family members and friends, you know, or having to go after loans from the government in order to be able to remain overseas. And this is causing them, you know, considerable stress.
But it's not just a psychological impact on stranded citizens.
What we found is a range of things. So, you know, we looked at the health and mental health impacts, and so that includes, as I said before, you know, concerns around depression and anxiety and stress. You know, we've also found, you know, people having to, you know, take up places in homeless shelters because their, you know, accommodations, you know, have dropped through, or they haven't got the funds to continue to pay for living in hotels or paying the rent overseas. You know, beyond that, then we've got, you know, people reporting financial stress. So, you know, having to, you know, to borrow back money, you know, to dip into their super, you know, to be able to continue to reside overseas. And for many of these people, you know, they have tried and attempted numerous times to return to Australia.
The survey included different countries such as New Zealand, Canada and the US. However, Associate Professor Seal says neither of these countries fully supported stranded citizens.
Over 98 different web pages, and certainly what we found, you know, across the 11 countries we reviewed was that, you know, none of the countries had resources or information to all of the different fields that we were interested in. And, you know, while some countries had, you know, emergency funds readily available, others, you know, you had to apply for a loan in order to get that, and you had to apply, you know, repay the loan within 6 months.
Associate Professor Seal says several issues need to be addressed before opening the borders.
It's about ensuring that, you know, the residents and the citizens who have been stranded abroad for a long period of time have the financial means to continue to live where they're living, and also to pay the airfares once flights become available. That has certainly been a huge issue. And then beyond that, we need to sort out this issue around vaccination. So making sure that we understand which vaccines are going to be acceptable, and what's going to happen to those people who have perhaps received a vaccine, but the vaccine was from one of the other manufacturers, not yet approved on the TGA website, to give them guidance around what happens once they enter into Australia.
Associate Professor from the School of Population Health at the University of New South Wales, Holly Seal, speaking with The Wire's Demetra Allen.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
Today is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Remembrance Day. One in three Australian women are affected by a miscarriage. It's one of the most prevalent health issues our communities face, yet it is still faced with silence from workplaces, health services, and communities. The grief experience for bereaved parents leads to poor mental health outcomes such as anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress, and suicidal thoughts. CEO and co-founder of Pink Elephant, Samantha Payne, speaks with The Wire's Tia Yuen.
Because for too long the experience of miscarriage has been shrouded in false narratives, a lack of research, taboo, silence, and from that, no one's addressed the issue head on. It took our organisation to drive legislative change to make bereavement leave just for miscarriage. Prior to us, that was never championed before. So I really just think it has been an oversight, but I also think that it can no longer be an oversight because I've been in this space for 6 years now, and for 6 years we have been lobbying for the same thing, and we're still yet to see any real progress from government in regards to addressing the needs of women and their partners who go through miscarriage.
So what actions would you like the government and private sectors to address?
Yeah, we really want to see cross-sector collaboration now. We want to see consumer advocacy and consumer opinion put at the heart of this, because we are the women that go through the devastation, the trauma of losing our babies, and yet we are being failed by the health system at multiple points, and the health system ultimately is managed by the Department of Health and government. So we need to even step up and specifically address this issue and work with peak bodies who have the ability to drive change within hospitals, within GPs, and within sonography. So yeah, I guess we want to see cross-sector collaboration that delivers action rather than just policy change.
This issue also shows us that we need to change our language and actions rather than diminishing and saying at least it happened early or miscarriage is common, they happen. Along with changing the way we speak about this issue, what else can the community be doing?
Hugely, you're so right, and thanks for bringing that up. We need to move away from minimising the experience of early pregnancy loss. We need to move towards validation, empathy and understanding. We need to understand that miscarriage is not something many women get over within a week. It's profound, it's lifelong changing, and it has an effect for many years afterwards. It's almost like living two lives. So an awareness and an understanding around the fact that women who lose their babies will always remember due dates, they will always remember anniversaries. we would have a child starting kindy next year that we don't have anymore. And we will always look at that and we will always think of that child. So I guess we need to foster better understanding around the length of this journey, but also the mental health, because if women and their partners are not supported, we are seeing very real poor mental health outcomes. We're seeing anxiety, depression, even suicidal thoughts for our community. For up to 3 years after a loss, they're at significant clinical risk of poor mental health. So again, that's just another way that we need all of society to come together, so workplaces, government and general community, to understand this issue better, because it's 1 in 3 women. It's not small, it's a huge portion of our population who face this challenge.
And they're suffering in silence as well, which is very unfortunate.
Yes, 100%. The silence is deafening. The silence says to a woman who's just experienced the death of her baby, your baby didn't exist, your baby didn't matter, your experience doesn't matter. And they internalise all of that negatively. And then what happens is then they are, again, more likely to have those poor mental health outcomes because they're silenced in their grief and they're isolated. And we're really worried right now because we've just gone through extreme lockdowns and we're seeing that present in our communities even more, because those women were having the most devastating news alone in scans without support people. They were in hospital, having procedures, waking up on maternity wards without support people, and they leave hospital without a baby in their arms, and there is no one there to support them. There is no clear referral pathway to Pink Elephant support. They have to find us their own ways. And then after that, there is no follow-up with the healthcare system to check in on their well-being like you get with any other postpartum checkup 6 weeks afterwards.
I was going to ask, for the women and families that do experience miscarriage, what are the types of supports available to them?
It's ad hoc at best. It's definitely got better in the last 6 years. We're the early pregnancy loss specialist, if you like, so we focus on a loss prior to 20 weeks, and we support women across the whole journey, so that includes things like pregnancy after loss and anxiety then as well. We're very much peer support, which means we're women who've gone through this who are holding space and supporting others. There are other organisations that, yes, may be more later-term focused, but they can offer additional support that's in the clinical side of things. And they should also be supported in terms of addressing this issue as well. But there really is only a handful of organisations who are working on an extremely big problem.
That was CEO and co-founder of Pink Elephant, Samantha Payne, speaking with The Wire's Tia Yuen. If this has raised issues for you or someone you know, contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan in Brisbane. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on ACCC 102.1 FM, to our friends in Morwell, Victoria on Gippsland FM, and to the other side of the country to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. As the Queensland government is pursuing autonomous military drone technology to develop its advanced manufacturing capabilities, experts are questioning the ethics around the use of autonomous weaponry. The Wire's Alexis Pink has the story.
The Queensland state government is embarking on a push to expand defence industries as part of its investment into advanced manufacturing in the state. Among the projects Queensland is pursuing right now is the Unmanned Autonomous Vehicle project through Boeing, the first for the company outside the United States to produce unmanned drones for the Royal Australian Air Force. The project has been in place for many months, but recently Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk announced a manufacturing facility would be built at the Wellcampens port site in Toowoomba to build the aircraft.
Today we can confirm that a site and an agreement has been reached, and we are very much looking forward to having this facility located here in Toowoomba at Wellcamp. And this loyal wingman is going to transform the way in which we improve our defence capability right here in Queensland.
Partnerships like this have been key to industry policy in Queensland, but this project in particular has turned a few heads. UAVs are at the cutting edge of artificial intelligence research, both in producing unarmed vehicles, like the Loyal Wingman, but also on armed vehicles. The ethics of allowing AI to make life or death decisions is being questioned. National Campaign Coordinator for the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, Matilda Byrne, outlined what those concerns are.
So the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots emerged as a response to the, I guess, emergence of AI being used in weapons. And what we're particularly concerned about is lethal autonomous weapon systems or fully autonomous weapons, killer robots, there's a few interchangeable names. The real concern about these weapons, which are under development, is that they operate without any human control. So over the selecting of targets and choosing to attack a target, to deploy force and kill potentially a person on the battlefield, this would be done using AI only. And this is something that we feel crosses a moral red line. There's legal concerns. There's also great security concerns. And so really, the campaign is about establishing regulation. And we're calling for the adoption of a new international treaty, some kind of law that outrightly prohibits certain types of autonomous weapons and then regulates the rest.
One of the key issues highlighted by the campaign has been what level of autonomy from human control an AI should be given to make life or death decisions in combat situations.
A big part of the AI ethics is around this idea of making decisions. And so there is a real concern if we delegate the whole decision-making process to an AI algorithm. So an AI algorithm that's fully responsible for some kind of input data to find a target, whether that's an object or potentially a human, what data they're using, reading that data, and then making, with their processing, a decision to then attack or not. So this is where we think we really need to have human control and that human control is crucial.
There are also concerns around the level of autonomy a military AI is given and the accountability for the decisions made on the battlefield.
Delegating life-death decisions to AI is something that's more broadly being discussed as well and is something that, you know, people in the industry themselves, AI developers, AI scientists, are also really concerned about. And AI doesn't have the capacity to appreciate humanity, to appreciate human life. And so from a moral standpoint, also shouldn't be given the ability to make that decision. And I think as well, in the context of warfare, what that does to dehumanize warfare, to perhaps make warfare more palatable or easier to enter into, is exactly why it is really important that humans are involved in those critical decisions. We have heard governments say in discussions around autonomous weapons that someone will always be held responsible. There needs to be human responsibility somewhere in the chain of command. But the reality is this is actually quite difficult because someone who decides to employ a particular system, if something goes wrong, if there's a machine error, if it behaves totally unpredictably, which we know can happen with AI, they didn't necessarily foresee those consequences. And so it's hard to put the fault on that individual. Similarly, it's really difficult to put blame, say, with the developer or the manufacturer because they might be developing something for a particular context, a certain use with specific training data, for instance, and then in a situation where that weapon is then taken and not used in those circumstances, they also cannot be held accountable. And so where to place blame, I think, is a really difficult question. And the reality is that if you safeguard that human involvement, that's where it comes down to, and that is where we can continue to hold people accountable in the case that something does go wrong.
National Coordinator on the Campaign to End Killer Robots, Matilda Byrne. Ending the story by The Wire's Alexis Bing. One of the ways the world is tackling climate change is to limit car emissions through the use of electric vehicles. Electric cars have taken off big time in Europe, but you won't see too many on Australian roads just yet. The Wire's Alex Sanderson explores why Aussies are finding it so hard to make the switch.
When we think of cars in Australia, we normally think of cars that sound like these. What if the majority of cars sounded like this? While the rest of the world is taking major steps in its mission to limit the amount of fossil fuels by moving onto electric and plug-in hybrid cars, Australia has been left behind. The rollout of electric and hybrid-powered vehicles around the globe is becoming increasingly popular. especially in areas such as Europe, with these types of vehicles outselling diesel vehicles for the first time in August of 2021 and making up 21% of the European market share. In stark comparison, in Australia, the market share of both electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids made up for less than 1%. So why is Australia lagging so far behind in the mission to limit our carbon emissions? There have been many reasons touted as to why Australia has fallen so far away from other parts of the world in the rollout of electric vehicles. Senior journalist from Wheels magazine David Benici says that there are a number of reasons as to why Australians are hesitant to make the switch.
Look, it starts with, you know, the old reasons such as range anxiety. You know, a lot of Australians, that's in people's mind when they buy a car. And I think the range anxiety, which is then sort of amplified by the lack of infrastructure. So it's all very well to say, okay, I've got an EV, it's going to take me 600K and I can drive from, you know, Adelaide to Melbourne and maybe I can stop halfway and charge. But then you try to say, okay, where are their chargers on the Western Highway? So there are issues, and that's getting better now through to sort of governments of all areas pitching in and some good sort of Australian companies that are doing it commercially. And then there are the fact old habits die hard. People factor in petrol stations into their trips and they think, oh, I'll spend 15 minutes at a petrol station. It's amazing how long you actually spend at a petrol station, especially on a big trip where if you buy food and all that, you can, you know, can end up being half an hour, but they don't sort of think of that. So once people get used to that, then they'll come round to buying an EV. Then the problem is lack of affordability for the purchase price. And that's hampered by lack of government incentives. And that's where that all comes into it. When you're comparing something like a Hyundai Kona EV, which is sort of $63,000-$65,000 next to a petrol Hyundai Kona, you know, we're looking at a $15,000-$20,000 price difference at the top spec, and people just still aren't quite prepared for that more, even though over time the running costs might even out.
Noah Schultz-Bayard, SA Director of the Australia Institute, also states that lack of government incentives are an issue, as well as state governments giving even further disincentive to go green, with taxes being placed per kilometre driven on electric vehicles in states such as Victoria and South Australia.
It takes a combined team effort for a country to fail as dismally as Australia has when it comes to the uptake of electric vehicles. And there's a lack of leadership. Yeah, certainly in a policy sense, when it comes to EVs in this country. Starting from the federal government level, there has never been a cohesive policy or set of policies or framework put in place that would encourage manufacturers to bring electric vehicles to the country and encourage Australians to buy them as consumers. We can see in other jurisdictions, other countries, other states in the US and places around the world where the government has for a long time now been putting in place incentives to increase the uptake of EVs. Those policies have really worked. There's a whole range of things that governments could be doing, such as purchase subsidies to lower the sticker price, the upfront cost of EVs, which we know is a big barrier to entry for purchases, but also other things, reductions in registration fees or priority parking spaces, or in other jurisdictions, people are allowed to drive in the city during high congestion times or use bus lanes if they're driving an EV. There are places in the world where these sorts of policies have been on the table for decades, and the results speak for themselves. EV sales in those areas are through the roof. Unfortunately, we have a situation where the federal government in Australia has not put any of those sorts of policies in place. And now we're facing a situation where state governments are attempting to move ahead and put a new tax on electric vehicles, a road user charge. The different states, different jurisdictions across the country are at different points in implementing their road user charges. But when we're in a situation where we should be encouraging more electric vehicles onto our roads, the last thing we should be doing is slapping a new tax on technology that we need to reduce pollution.
The Wire's Alex Anderson with that report. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you're in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week, same time, on your local station. If you would like to listen to any of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. Get in touch with us on social media. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word, on Twitter, or search us on Facebook at The Wire Independent Current Affairs on Radio around Australia. The Wire acknowledges the traditional owners of the Turrbal land where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from our studios at Radio 4EB in Brisbane. I'm Eduardo Jordan. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll hear you next time on The Wire.